Well, we turn to 1 Samuel and to chapter 15 this evening as we continue to look at the life and times of Samuel the prophet, trying to understand what the world of his day was like, and then make comparisons with the day and age and situation in which we find ourselves as well. So again, looking at the whole chapter, but reading verses 1 to 23 of 1 Samuel 15. Samuel said to Saul, "I am the one the Lord sent to anoint you king over his people Israel. So listen now to the message from the Lord. This is what the Lord Almighty says. I will punish the Amalekites for what they did to Israel when they waylaid them as they came up from Egypt. Now go, attack the Amalekites and totally destroy everything that belongs to them. Do not spare them. Put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys." So Saul summoned the men and mustered them at Telaim, 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 men from Judah. Saul went to the city of Amalek and set an ambush in the ravine. Then he said to the Kenites, "Go away, leave the Amalekites so that I do not destroy you along with them. For you showed kindness to all the Israelites when they came up out of Egypt." So the Kenites moved away from the Amalekites. And then Saul attacked the Amalekites all the way from Havilah to Shur to the east of Egypt. He took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive, and all his people he totally destroyed with the sword. But Saul and the army spared Agag and the best of the sheep and cattle, the fat calves and lambs, everything was good. These they were unwilling to destroy completely, but everything that was despised and weak they totally destroyed. Then the word of the Lord came to Samuel. "I'm grieved that I've made Saul king, because he has turned away from me and has not carried out my instructions." Samuel was troubled, and he cried out to the Lord all that night. Early in the morning, Samuel got up and went to meet Saul. But he was told, "Saul has gone to Carmel. There he has set up a monument in his own honor, and has turned and gone on down to Gilgal." When Samuel reached him, Saul said, "The Lord bless you. I've carried out the Lord's instructions." But Samuel said, "What then is this bleating of sheep in my ears? What is this lowing of cattle that I hear?" Saul answered, "The soldiers brought them from the Amalekites. They spared the best of the sheep and cattle to sacrifice to the Lord your God, but we totally destroyed the rest." "Stop," Samuel said to Saul. "Let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night." "Tell me," Saul replied. Samuel said, "Although you were once small in your own eyes, did you not become the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel, and he sent you on a mission saying, 'Go and completely destroy those wicked people, the Amalekites. Make war on them until you've wiped them out.' Why did you not obey the Lord? Why did you pounce on the plunder and do evil in the eyes of the Lord?" "But I did obey the Lord," Saul said. "I went on the mission the Lord assigned me. I completely destroyed the Amalekites and brought back Agag, their king. The soldiers took sheep and cattle from the plunder, the best of what was devoted to God, in order to sacrifice them to the Lord your God at Gilgal." But Samuel replied, "Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the voice of the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams. For rebellion is like the sin of divination, and arrogance like the evil of idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you as king. Solemn words. Strange passage with lots of things in it to alert our minds, and we'll look forward to saying more of that later on in the service. Well, our thoughts will be around the words we read together in 1 Samuel 15 this evening. We might call it simply the call of God for obedience, not sacrifice. Or another equally good title for the section is a hard lesson. And Saul was to have the toughest lesson probably of his whole life here. Chapter 15 of 1 Samuel is probably one of the most outstanding chapters of all the books of Samuel in the Old Testament. In truth, one of the most significant chapters in the whole Old Testament itself. It brings us right to the very heart of what God looks for and expects of human beings in every generation. Behind the actual narrative and storyline of this chapter, behind the events in Saul's life and the Amalekites and Agag and all the rest, is God saying, this is what I treasure more than anything else. This is what I'm looking for. Is look down upon humanity in its great need. This is what I'm really about. And the two things that I want to leave with you and finish them off by tying them into Palm Sunday and the Easter week. First of all, I think God made it clear to Saul that he wanted a proper perspective on sin. Proper perspective on sin. The judgment of God on the Amalekites is the crunch issue at the start of the chapter. Basically, God calls Saul, as king of Israel, to exterminate the whole Amalekite race. Everything that belongs to the Amalekites. Its people, its cattle and flocks, and literally everything else that belonged to them was under the ban, under the curse of God. It's a situation reminiscent of when Israel first crossed over the River Jordan and into Jericho, and God said, I want the holiest to be banned substances dedicated to me, not for you to enjoy, but as a sign of my utter rejection of the sin of the Canaanite people. And so in chapter 15 and verse 3, there's an echo of that same kind of attitude in God. Go and attack the Amalekites and totally destroy everything that belongs to them. There are plenty of good Christians today who still struggle with that kind of demand by God and puzzle over God's declaration to Saul to wipe out a whole nation, lock, stock and barrel. Maybe yourself have been faced by people asking you the question, how can you justify such an action? How can you reconcile that a God of grace and mercy, whose character we celebrate through the cross and resurrection of Jesus, can be the same God who says to a king in Israel, wipe out the Amalekites, totally destroy everything that belongs to them? You can understand a bit better if you say, well, go and find the core evil leaders of that nation. Find the bad eggs in the basket of the Amalekites and treat them harshly, give them what they deserve. We might have understood if God had said, go and find the religious leaders of the paganism and idolatry amongst the Amalekites, those who are infecting that nation with bad belief systems, and deal with them. But God's call to Saul as king of Israel is to attack the Amalekites and totally destroy everything that belongs to them. God's view is simply that there is such a thing as corporate sin in a nation and in a whole human race. Corporate sin that in this case in the Amalekites tarnished everyone and everything within the nation. Those who had directly, consciously and willingly done evil, but equally those who had not were tarnished, contaminated by this infection of sin in the nation of the Amalekites. It's something we probably find uncomfortable at times to think our way through, and yet if you think back through human history, there are slightly parallel situations that might be helpful to ponder. During the Second World War, Hitler was the baddie, if you like. He was the one who had in his mind and heart the destruction of those who were not of Aryan race. He was the one who gave the orders for things to be done that were unrighteous and unjust. But the Allied attitude to Germany was not, we will go and single out one bad man and deal with him. The attitude was, the whole nation of Germany is guilty because it's part of this nation that Hitler rules over. And so there's corporate guilt, which one's saying every single person had done wrong in the matter, but that the guilt of the leader was shared by the rest. It's how God sees sin in the human race. Sin enters by one man, that's Adam. And the guilt of the whole human race is first and foremost not what I personally have done in my life, but first and foremost because I'm part of a race whose head, Adam himself, rebelled against God, sinned and fell, and so there's corporate guilt in the whole human race afterwards. The positive side, of course, of that is that it's the righteousness of Jesus, the goodness, the perfection of Jesus as the head of his new people that means that we stand forgiven at the cross. Sin is personal, but there are corporate aspects to it. That's the first bit about sin that is being taught in the chapter. Second is the issue that that sin, that evil, was serious enough to require eradication of the nation and of all its belongings. Everything had to be destroyed. So when you read on in verse 3, do not spare them. Put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys. The whole shebang. Which I think actually raises further questions and further dilemmas very often when people read a passage like this. God has spelled it out in detail. He's brought the uncomfortable things to the surface. Why the deliberate inclusion of women and children and infants? Specified, difficult things to swallow in any generation. But what God is saying is that sin is like a rottenness that is so spread through this nation of the Amalekites. It's like an infection or a cancer that needs radical surgery. You can't afford to leave even one seed of this disease left in the land, or soon the nation will be back to where it began from once more. And we need to understand sin like that. It needs to be our perspective on sin. That if we think, well, I can deal with X number of sins in my life and get rid of them and just hang on to one or two that are kind of a bit more trivial and don't have the same social consequences as other sins, then God will be perfectly content. God isn't perfectly content. His goal is the eradication of all sin. And in a sense, this particular chapter just highlights what ultimately is God's purpose in this world, to deal with sin fully and finally. Verse 2 indicates what the sin actually was. I'll punish the Amalekites for what they did to Israel when they waylaid them as they came up from Egypt. Here we go back into Numbers. We go back into that period when the Israelites came out of Egypt, across the Red Sea, through the wilderness journey. And at a certain stage in time, as they passed by Amalekite territory, they needed the basics of life, food and drink. The Amalekites rejected and refused that and gave Israel a hard time. For that sin, God says he's going to destroy the whole nation. Which again probably raises more questions initially than it answers. If we're talking about some horrendous moral catastrophe that the Amalekites were responsible for, we might say, well, yeah, they're getting what they deserve, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But when you read those words, I'll punish the Amalekites for what they did to Israel when they waylaid them as they came up from Egypt, it doesn't really sound like the crime of the century. It doesn't read like something of just of such an enormous scale of evil that it requires immediate eradication of the nation itself. And so this passage becomes one of those many illustrations that folk will use that we made reference to last Sunday morning. And folks say, ah, there you are, the God of the Old Testament was a God who was harsh and a God who's vindictive and a God who's bloodthirsty and a God who was unloving. And, well, can't wait to get into the New Testament, we find a totally different God who is kind and loving and gracious and merciful. We answer that as we did last Sunday morning by saying, first of all, God is an unchanging God. He is the same yesterday, today, and forever. He's the same Old Testament and New Testament. If we disrupt that concept of God being the same always, then we ultimately deny God himself. We can answer the criticism by saying, well, God is God. His thoughts are higher than our thoughts, his ways than our ways. God operates on a higher level than any human being can ever attain to. God sees things that we can't see with our eyes. He sees motives. He sees attitudes. He reads minds. He knows hearts. And he makes his judgment call on the basis of things that are beyond our grasp in totality. We can also answer the criticism, I think, here by delving a little bit into that actual history to which God is referring in these verses. Later on, when God deals with Agag, the king of the Amalekites, through Samuel, he touches on the fact that the Amalekites had committed what was essentially war crimes themselves. While it might read initially that they had just given the Israelites a hard time, they had waylaid them on the way up from Egypt. In fact, the behavior of the Amalekites towards Israel had been on a much more serious level of crime and vindictiveness. I think the second issue is simply that here's a reflection of how precious God's people are to him. The Amalekites thought, well, these are just some wandering nomad people who've come up out of Egypt after 400 years in slavery there. They don't count. But these were God's people. These were those whom God had entered into a covenant relationship with. This was the people through whom he'd bring good news to the whole world. God's whole plans of redemption for anyone who seeks him and finds him are rooted initially in his choice of Israel to be his covenant people. Mess with God's people and you have enormous circumstances and consequences to bear as a result. Again, I think we look at the situation and say it's about God's holiness. All sin offends a holy God as much as this does. When we look and say, this is what God says about these Amalekites who just gave Israel a rough time when they came up out of Egypt, surely that's not that big a deal. We have to know this is how God sees every sin. Every sin is worthy of death. Every sin is worthy of rejection. Every sin is worthy of extermination. Every sin offends the holiness of God as deeply as does the Amalekite sin and rebellion here. That's why at the end of time, God allows no sin into heaven and allows no unsaved sinner into heaven. This chapter in 1 Samuel gives us a very graphic picture of how seriously God tackles sin and the sinner. It's not trivial to him. It's not non-consequential to him. When God sees us rebel against him, he is offended to the heart of his being and must deal with that sin one way or another. Here, in a sense, that reminder that sets the tone for the New Testament that no sinner is good enough to enter heaven by himself. No sinner is good enough to escape God's righteous and eternal condemnation. None of us can come before God and say, well, I'm not as bad as Amalekites, God, so I know you'll love me a lot, won't you? Every one of us stands condemned before God if we have not attained his absolute perfect standard. So here, as throughout the New Testament more explicitly, the only way of acceptance with God is through our acceptance in Jesus as Redeemer and Deliverer and Saviour. So where does Saul stand in all this? Saul's been told, deal with the Amalekites. Eradicate this cancer in this society. Punish them on my behalf as a holy and a righteous God who treasures his people and is offended at the unholy way they're treated coming out of Egypt. And Saul says, yeah, I'll do that. And he gets his people together and heads off to give the Amalekites a hammering, a lesson. But he didn't really believe it totally. There's clearly that little bit in Saul that thinks, well, God's a bit OTT here. We don't need to be as radical as that. What harm could there be in sparing a few sheep and a few cattle? What harm is there in just sparing Agag, the king? We're not quite sure what his intention was, but he certainly had some plan up his sleeve for sparing the king Agag of the Amalekites. And so there's something that goes through Saul's head that says, I hear what God said. I hear what God requires. I see what God's view of the sin of the Amalekites is. But I think something slightly different. A big part of Saul's failure was his failure to keep a valid perspective of sin in his mind and heart. An attitude to sin that, in a sense, reflected the life and times of Samuel the prophet. That's what that world was like. So often amongst the people of Israel, we find people who believe that certain things were sinful and certain things were offensive to God's holiness and certain things should be punished, but not the whole deal. If anything, it's even more the case, surely, in our Western civilization today. Typically, in our generation, no sin is worthy of death. No crime worthy of capital punishment. Typically in our civilization, our wonderfully advanced world, no sin is seen as meriting hell and eternal destruction from the presence of God. Typically on the streets of our city, people might think that perhaps a child abuser should go to hell, but nothing else really is that bad. And somehow we just haven't understood sin from God's perspective. If that's the way that our society is affected, then sometimes we have to be careful it doesn't affect ourselves as well. The live and let live mentality doesn't take easily the concept of eradicating contamination totally. That's what God's about. His view of sin is that it's so abhorrent, so unwelcome, that he'll deal with it and deal with it permanently. We can never be on good terms with God if we don't have a proper perspective on sin. The second thing in the chapter that we see God looking for and not finding in Saul is a perfect pursuit of obedience. Throughout the chapter, we're given an insight into how Saul not just sees the sin of the Amalekites and what can be spared and overlooked, but we see Saul's attitude to obeying what God has commanded. We remind ourselves first, Saul, he did hear God's instructions. Verse 1, God says, listen now. And in verse 4, so Saul summoned his men and went. He heard the command clearly and plainly. There's no muddled confusion in his mind about what God had stipulated. God hadn't been a kind of bit ambiguous, so Saul had to make some discernment in terms of choice of what he did. There weren't different interpretations of what God had meant. God had said that everything Amalekite was to be destroyed. I think that's where we have that specific of the women, the children, and the infants. Although that's still hard for us to swallow, it's there because God is saying, I need it to be absolute and complete. And Saul heard that message. Saul understood that message. Saul didn't ever forget the message. When Samuel eventually confronts him in verse 13, his great cry of excitement, I've carried out the Lord's instructions. Verse 20, I completely destroyed the Amalekites. So what God has said to him, Saul has got, he understood what God was saying to him. But Saul seems to think in terms of the task of obedience that he can tailor the message to suit himself. And so he spares some of the sheep, he spares some of the cattle, he spares Agag, and we're not sure if there's more besides or not. Not completely clear whether it's Saul or his men who made the first decision along that line to spare Agag and to spare some of the animals as well. If you flip through the chapter later on, you'll see how interesting the language is. Verse 15, the soldiers brought them. Agag and the sheep and the cattle. Verse 21, the soldiers took the sheep and the cattle. So you might think, well, that's not Saul, that's the soldiers instead of Saul. But verse 19, Samuel says to him, why did you, Saul, pounce on the plunder? And he turns the spotlight on Saul himself. Verse 20, Saul's trying to defend himself and he says, I completely destroyed Amalek and I brought back Agag, their king. So in that situation, when he hasn't got the hot under the collar feeling yet, he's quite happy to say, I've done that. You know, I brought Agag back because he thought he could justify doing something God has said he shouldn't do. Verse 24, here's Saul claiming that, well, you know, Simon, it wasn't really me, but I was afraid of the rest of the guys and they were doing it. I was afraid of the people and so I gave in to them, is how he responds now. What do you believe out of all that? Was it the soldiers? Was it Saul? Was it Saul because he was afraid of the soldiers, afraid of the people? You can pay your money and take your choice almost. For it's hard to discern what really was the truth in Saul's heart. What is clear, what is absolute, is that Saul was culpable. He was the king. The nation had asked for a king who'd be like the kings of the nations around. So he was in absolute control. His was the final word. He had the final say. And so when Agag was spared and the sheep and the cattle were brought home, it was Saul who decided it was a good plan. And it's Saul who's responsible for this act of defiance and disobedience. We ask Saul, "Saul, do you think you were being disobedient when you did that?" And Saul said, "No, I don't think so. No, I've wiped out the Amalekites. I've conquered them. I've taken my men down. I've surrounded their city. I've wasted them. I've done what God asked me to do. It's only a few sheep and cattle. I brought them back to make a sacrifice in Gilgal to the Lord with them." And he honestly believes that little bit of disobedience doesn't outweigh the massive amount of obedience to God's command that had been his. He's putting it in modern language. "Well, come on, I've obeyed God 90%. So you can overlook it to be 10% or 5%, or maybe it's only 1% of disobedience. You know, basically, I've obeyed God. And it's only a wee tiny bit of disobedience. And that was for good reason anyway, wasn't it? Those who are in university will be doing their final dissertations fairly soon. And they would have worked very hard, of course, and studied very thoroughly. Won't you, Garth? And they'll not expect to have 100% in any of their essays or dissertations or whatever. If they pass, they'll be content. If they score somewhere in about the 80%, they'll be really proud. If they get above 90%, they'll think that's just perfect. But none of them get 100%. Never worked out why, but teachers and educationalists never seem to give 100%. And they give it perfect. And I guess that folks grew up thinking, well, nobody can ever reach perfection, can they? So long as you're getting pretty high, pretty close to it, that's all that really matters. If the roast came out of the oven today and looked well cooked and was nice and tender and succulent and juicy inside, and your wife set it down before you, or the husband set it down before the wife, and you said, "Wow, that's perfect." It wasn't. No such thing as perfect. We kind of get muddled up between what's excellent and what's perfect in life very often. But God doesn't get muddled up like that. Perfection to God is perfection. In this context, obedience to God meant total obedience. Not half and half obedience, not 80% obedience, not 90% obedience, not even 99.9% obedience. What God required was total obedience. And Saul didn't get that. Saul thought that God should be perfectly content with high scores, high percentages. And God says, rebellion, verse 23, rebellion is like the sin of divination. Saul, you may as well have gone to a witch's conclave and dabbled on the occult as think that you can please me with 95% obedience and toss the other 5% to one side. Arrogance was how God sees Saul here. Arrogance is like the evil of idolatry. So he's going around saying, "I gave God pretty good standard of obedience. I wiped out most of the Amalekites. I've only kept Agag and a few sheep and cattle there for sacrificial purposes anyway. Aren't I a good guy? But your little bit of disobedience may as well have been blatant idolatry. For you've disregarded me, the living God, as much as an idolater who bows down to a piece of wood or stone and starts to worship it." Saul is not praised for 90% obedience. He's condemned for deliberate inexcusable disobedience. To him that knows to do good and does it not, to him it is sin. It may just be one little bit out of this whole panorama of what God asked him to do, but God focuses on the shortcoming, because disobedience is 100% disobedience, whatever its context has been. I guess lots of us, if we're honest, feel a wee bit sorry for Saul. After all, he'd been pretty much down the line, he'd nearly got it right. And of course, we tend ourselves to think that that's how God looks at us. You know, if I have 10 commandments in front of me and can get to the end of the day and say, God, you know my life, that I kept every one of the first 9. Sorry, I messed up a wee bit on number 10, but I got 9 of them dead right all the way through the day. And there's only one commandment I broke today, Lord. Aren't I good? And we think God will look at us and say, yeah, it's brilliant, Trevor. You know, 90% obedience, only 10% failure rate. That's pretty good going. We imagine that that's how God views the issue of our obedience to him. Is there somehow we can do a barter with God? Lord, I'll get as much right as I can, and I know you'll just excuse the rest. It's actually a painful lesson when you start to look back through your own life, as I look back through mine, and think of times when I've patted myself on the back, as it were, thinking, well, I've done that for God and done that for God. And I know I didn't. I knew that was an area of disobedience. I knew that was an area of sin. I knew that was an area where there's a specific command from God and I was rejecting it. And I think, well, that's a tough area of my life, Lord. You understand that, don't you? And I think, well, all this big chunk of 90% obedience, shall that well outweighs the 10% of disobedience. When Saul clearly felt and thought that way, he demonstrated he didn't understand the perfect pursuit of obedience that God was requiring. You think, Saul, to keep these perfect sheep and cattle, to offer them as part of your religious sacrifice, away with it. I want obedience. Rather than all the sacrificial rites and rituals put together. God's God requires 100% in terms of righteousness and is abhorred by even one tiny little sin. And God's a God who wants 100% obedience and is utterly dismayed when we give him less and think it doesn't really matter, no big deal. I sort of want to finish on a Palm Sunday theme. He said, where on earth is that going to come from here? Well, this story ends sadly with Saul being told through Samuel from God, you are no longer a suitable king for this country. God is removing you from your kingship. God is sad, sorry, he repents that he ever made you king of this country. It's radical language, isn't it? I said, well, is that not God being a wee bit hard on Saul? When Saul had got 90% of obedience and when he had rid so much of the Amalekite sin in the world? No, God wanted a king who would be clear in his perspective on sin and strong in his pursuit of obedience. And he didn't find it in Saul. But entering into Jerusalem centuries later was the one whom God had always wanted to be the true king of his people. He was entering the crunch battle in God's age-long war against sin and Satan. And as Jesus rides into the city of Jerusalem on the colt of an ass, we see both his proper perspective on sin and his perfect pursuit of obedience. Jesus takes sin so seriously that he, the perfect one, goes to the cross to take my sin upon himself and at the cost of his own life, settle the debt I owe. That's a proper perspective on sin, isn't it? Somebody takes it really seriously. And he is obedient unto death, as Paul would say to the Philippians, even the death of the cross. Even when obedience to his Father meant entering a world of sin and rejection, when it meant being despised and rejected of men and a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, even when obedience to the Father meant the ignominy of dying upon a cross, even when obedience to the Father meant identifying with all of our sin and all of our shame and all of our guilt and becoming a man of sin for us, yet to the 100% mark, Jesus obeys the Father. If Saul has rejected his king for an improper perspective on sin, an imperfect pursuit of obedience, then today we rejoice in Jesus as true king. For he took sin seriously enough to die for it, and pursued obedience thoroughly enough to go to the cross for it. Here is our true King, and we bless God for him. Let's pray together. Father, we recognize that many of the thoughts in this chapter are tough for us and tough for our world and our society to grapple with. And yet deep down we see the importance of having a view of sin, its guilt, its shame, and its necessary punishment as what was being set before Saul and his nation at that point in time. We sense that call you had upon him and his people to be 100% obedient to you, to recognize that that was where the bar sat at. What's for the level that you required of us? We thank that in our Easter story, we turn our eyes upon Jesus, and in him we see one who understood those things fully and practiced and lived them to the full. So by his attitude to sin and by his perfect obedience, we could find acceptance with you. And so today we come with our sin. We come with our imperfect obedience and rest ourselves in Jesus and in him alone. I need no other righteousness. I need no other plea. It is enough that Jesus died and that he died for me. And we thank you from the bottom of our hearts. Amen.